from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I think everyone who knows me knows this isn't a budget that I would draft by myself. But it is a budget given the reality of the makeup of the General Assembly. It is a budget given the reality and the philosophy of our governor that I believe we can all work with.
We've always had technically a balanced budget, but this is, we're not cutting edges. We're going to have enough money to pay for our medical bills and a lot more money for education. It's a shame we had to go through the 2 or 3 years of instability, but it's been settled this year, and we'll see what happens in November and what people think.
My daughter doesn't need an Equal Rights Amendment. My granddaughters don't need it. We don't need something on a piece of paper that says it. We're at a place today, ladies, where we are equal with our rights. Stand up for them. Vote no.
We have a president in the White House right now. If he could gut the Civil Rights Act of 1965, he would do it, and he'd do it now. I would rather rely on the U.S. Constitution than a statute that can be changed by Donald Trump. Let's vote yes and pass the ERA now.
I was asked to come forward today by the people who knew about the abuse that I've suffered after I rejected the inappropriate actions of Representative Lou Lane.
I'm going to say this just once. From beginning to end, the allegations are absurd. Because of the earlier press conference today, I have submitted a formal request to the Legislative Inspector General to begin an immediate investigation. Additionally, after consultation with Speaker Madigan, I have decided to submit my resignation from my post as House Deputy Majority Leader.
A day after shepherding the ERA to ratification in the Illinois House, State Representative Lou Lang steps down from leadership amid allegations of inappropriate behavior. Is it the latest Me Too allegation, or is something else going on? Meanwhile, about that Equal Rights Amendment, it's been 36 years since a federal deadline expired. We'll talk about what's next. But first, Illinois has a budget, a full-year budget, balanced, and it passed on time. Am I dreaming? I'm Brian Mackey in the Illinois Capitol. Sean Crawford is away. In studio on the campus of the University of Illinois Springfield are Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois and a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer, Daisy Contreras, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter, and Rachel Otwell, our colleague, reporter and producer for NPR Illinois in Springfield. With me also in the Statehouse is Hannah Meisel, a freelance reporter who was most recently a contributor to the political blog and newsletter Capital Facts. Hannah, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
All right, let's start right in with the budget. Hannah, talk a little bit about what is in this budget this year.
So it's a, you know, like you said, a balanced budget for the first time in years and years, $38.5 billion. That's an increase of about $1.1 billion from last year. Important things it does is it fully funds the evidence-based school aid formula that took up so much time last year and, you know, was the subject of so much partisan rancor and but, you know, in the end, it got done. And people were really worried, actually, earlier this year that a budget wouldn't fully fund it. And then we also have more than $53 million for the Quincy Veterans Home for repairs there. That was a very important priority of everyone, but especially the governor's office, seeing as, you know, how much blame has been laid at the feet of the governor for the deaths that happened from Legionnaires' disease there. We also have $172 million included for improvements for the Obama Presidential Library, improvements to Jackson Park up in Chicago, probably a trade there. And then we also, interestingly, we're still relying on $270 million in savings, assuming that we sell the Thompson Center. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, as an analyst, I think I've said this before, joke that that's almost a recurring revenue source instead of a one-time revenue source. That's the last time I'm going to tell that joke on the show, I promise. Daisy, you covered a little bit of the higher ed aspect of the budget. I know the State Week Universe includes a lot of radio stations like NPR Illinois, WUIS, that are based at institutions of higher ed. What does this budget do for institutions of higher education?
Over the past few years, higher ed has not received enough funding. There have been, you know, they've received some money, but it hasn't really been enough to reach their 2015, what they used to have to cover a lot of ground. And now there's this whole argument that Illinois students are leaving Illinois to go to other universities out of state. And so part of this budget is to give more scholarships to students to stay in state. So there's this new proposal, Aim High grant scholarships that will match, the state will match in institutional scholarships for students to stay here. And I think that that's one of the probably the biggest aspects for the higher ed portion of this, more grants to research centers and some things like that.
And an overall increase, I think, of what, two percentage points in the higher ed budget over the prior year? But
yeah,
like you said, still not
still
back
not
to where
enough.
It had been a few years ago. Yeah.
Right.
Hannah, what I was thinking, there, you know, I'm trying to figure out what was the inflection point here of why this budget was so much easier to pass than, well, frankly, that maybe that's not even the right way to say it. Why it was possible to pass a budget on time that was mostly balanced and fully funded, you know, by this deadline when it hadn't been. Is it, you know, the fact of the governor's perceived weakness, his, you know, narrow primary win? Is it the, you know, simply the factor of more tax money being available?
I think it's all of those things. I mean, certainly, you know, bash as he might, the tax increase that we got last summer, the governor is definitely going to be able to use all of that money for, you know, things like ribbon cuttings. And, you know, it's an election year, so that also plays a major factor. But also, I think that the bridges that had been built last year when the Senate, you know, leaders in the Senate had tried to negotiate the so-called grand bargain, I think that, you know, even though ultimately the governor stepped in and kind of interfered with that process, bridges had been built. And so when we asked, when reporters asked Senator Heather Staines the other night, you know, what was it? When did this process really start? You know, when did people start trusting each other? And she harkened back to something her colleague, Republican Dale Ryder, you know, had said, it's like testing the ice. When it's first frozen, you go a couple steps and you make sure that it's not cracking, and then you go a couple more steps. So it sounds like trust was really the factor here.
And then, you know, and going with what Hannah is saying, there was this sense of bipartisan cooperation, and it was being said a lot. You know, there's a love fest between Democrats and Republicans being able to work together, and they kept praising each other with how they were able to reach this this cooperation. So does this mean that we will see more cooperation in the future as we move forward? Is the budget kind of that setting that example for how government should continue to work? I don't know. We'll see, right?
Yeah, Charlie, I mean, is this should we really are we heaping too much praise on them for doing something they should be doing anyway? I mean, is this the, you know, the kid who remembers to turn the lights off and wants a cookie for it or something?
Well, I was glad to see that, from my perspective, that common sense prevailed. In the sense, like I've said a couple times on the show, that I didn't think lawmakers wanted to go home for the summer leading up to the election and have to tell constituents, I'm sorry, we couldn't get the most basic thing done because we have this standoff, this partisan ideological battle. And so we may not be able to get schools open for you, that in-home service that helps your grandma stay at home, we may not be able to fund that. They didn't want that. I think people on both sides of the aisle realized that what we went through during that 700-plus day period of not having any real budget in place and operating under court orders and consent decrees and continuing appropriations, that just could not persist. And I believe that last summer, when the small group of Republicans joined with Democrats to override the governor's veto on a budget and on a tax increase, kind of was the handwriting on the wall that we were going to get it done this spring.
Hannah, do you think that this budget will, I mean, the governor put out a statement saying, I know a lot of people characterized it as saying he would sign it, but actually what he said is he will take action to enact the budget. Do you think that this is going to continue to be a political issue, a political football this year, the way it's been for the past few years?
The governor has never been shy about the fact that he feel, you know, he's going to use the tax issue. He's going to until his last breath. I mean, it was a major thing when he ran in 2014, because the temporary income tax hike that had been enacted in 2011 was going to sunset that January 1st. And, you know, he promised and promised and promised over and over again that he would, you know, make sure that it stays low. And then last summer, when he was overridden on the budget and we got, you know, almost back up to 5%, you know, he was furious. And so I do think that, of course, he's going to keep using it on the campaign trail. And, you know, he might blast his own budget. I think he'll be careful, maybe a little more careful than he normally would. However, yes, you know, if he has that tool in his arsenal, he's going to use it. But that, like we said earlier, at the same time, he's going to use Governor Rauner, not candidate Rauner, is going to be able to use all the money from the tax increase to do the things that governors do, including, you know, ribbon cuttings for new construction. And, you know, there's in the budget, there's $400 million for deferred maintenance. And, you know, IDOT can get going on projects that had actually been canceled or delayed in 2015 when the budget impasse started.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating point, Hannah, because the governor really shied away from doing a lot of those ribbon cuttings and, you know, showing up at employers during the budget impasse, you know, doing the sort of things that governors do. I mean, I remember Governor Quinn would always announce, you know, there was almost no amount of new jobs in the state too small for him to show up and hold a press conference to tell, you know, 15 people getting hired here or something. Yeah. I mean, it's a slight exaggeration, but I thought it was telling. Literally on the governor's public schedule for Friday, as we go to air taping this, there is an event, ribbon cutting, with the IDOT secretary in Macomb. So yes, he definitely seems to be eager to take advantage of the opportunities to spend this money.
Well, I thought the governor's choice of words was interesting, because he can use his powers, his veto powers under the Constitution, to reduce some of the sums that are appropriated, to entirely eliminate some of those. And the way the process is set up, if he takes an appropriation bill that has, what, how many pages was this, 1,500 pages? And he cuts out individual pieces, when he files that veto saying, I'm cutting this, reducing this other, everything else becomes law. So he could decide, for example, I don't want this grant to go to do XYZ, wipe it out, the rest of the budget remains intact, and then the legislature has the opportunity to come back and consider whether to put the money back in. And if he wipes it out entirely, it takes 3/5. If he just reduces a sum from $50 to $25, it takes a simple majority to put it back.
Yeah, and Charlie, I had that exact same thought because it seems like such a peculiar phrasing. Why wouldn't you just say he's going to, you know, his office say he'll sign the budget instead of work to, or, you know, take action to enact the budget, as he said. I will say, however, I did some reporting on that, and I was basically told that I'm overreading into it. So we'll see what happens with that. Hannah, I wanted to wrap up our budget discussion by, you know, the credit rating agencies have all been carefully watching Illinois. We had a bill backlog last year at this time that was, what, $15 billion, give or take a billion. We cut that mostly more than in half by bonding some of that debt. Are we going to continue to make progress on the bill backlog with this year's budget?
Actually, no. That was one of the chief regrets, I think, that Senator Heather Staines told reporters that she had. But, you know, so the bill backlog will mostly remain at its current high billion dollar backlog where it's at now. But it was also that way for years, even before Governor Rauner came in. So is it ideal? Obviously not. But can the state withstand it? I think history says yes.
Yeah, and I guess the difference is businesses can wait months to get paid for the services they render to the state instead of waiting years in some cases. Rachel Otwell, I want to bring you into the discussion. The Equal Rights Amendment passed the House this week after 2 hours of debate and 2 months of discussion and speculation, but arguably this has been something that has been talked about in Springfield a heck of a lot longer than that. I guess let's just begin by, Rachel, saying what is the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, simply put, it is wordage that says basically rights should not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. As you mentioned, this debate is nothing new. It passed Congress in 1972, went to the states for ratification, fell short. They had imposed a deadline, ended up extending it to 1982, and there were still 35 states that ratified it, and 38 were needed. Illinois, it was a surprise to many that Illinois was not able to ratify it. It was the only northern state that didn't. Phyllis Schlafly, having Illinois as her headquarters to oppose it, probably had something to do with that. But the first time I covered it actually was in 2014 when there was a resolution in the Senate. It passed but did not get through the House. And in 2003, the House had passed it but not the Senate. So it's been around for a while, obviously, though, came to a head this year.
And this is something that it's already in the Illinois Constitution. So in some sense, the law in Illinois would not be changed necessarily in terms of state laws if this passed. But obviously, this is something that is a deep issue for a lot of people, a lot of women in particular. Remember the battles around the ERA here that you cited? I mean, it got pretty rough and tumble in the Capitol with people chaining themselves together outside the chamber door. And in one instance, famously, using pig's blood, I think?
They convinced a slaughterhouse to give them some pig's blood and spelled out the name of the speaker at the time, George Ryan, and pig's blood on the floor. Yeah, so there were some radical actions that had been taken. Things didn't get quite that intense this year, but kind of came down to being close to the final hour as spring session wrapped up, although it could have been voted on into the fall. And there were a lot of rallies and a lot of activism going on about the ERA throughout the past few months, as you noted.
And I guess it didn't matter what side of the issue you were on. It was a unique experience, I think. Hannah and I were on the House floor that day, just kind of listening in as legislators were kind of presenting their viewpoints. It didn't matter what side of the aisle you were on, they felt really strongly about their view, and just being there as the votes were coming in and legislators holding their breath to see if the needed 71 votes would actually come in, and it actually got 72 votes in the House. So
one vote to spare. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was a very dramatic moment, right? Because the roll call was held open for quite a long time.
Oh, yeah. I think the video I took ended up being like 45, 50 seconds is certainly the longest roll call I've ever seen.
And just sort of waiting, and you'd have one vote, and then maybe a few more seconds, mm-hmm. and then another vote would flip. Rachel, let's just to give due diligence here. What were some of the arguments that people were making against supporting this? Because as Lou Lang, who sponsored this, said, he can't understand and imagine why you would oppose equal rights for men and women. So what are the arguments against it?
So those who are against it use some of the same arguments Phyllis Schlafly used about co-ed prisons, women having to join the military if there were to be a draft, which Lang said, you know, Congress could decide to instate a draft at this point and include women anyway. But really, the thing that shifted this year from my past year covering it was the abortion. That was really the sticking point. And we know that issue when it comes to the race for governor is coming up. It's an election year. There are people on the right who want to be seen as pro-life and don't want to vote for something that arguably could give women more access to abortion. However, supporters never, you know, in my experience covering it, abortion was not, you know, the number one reason people were supporting it in the first place. And it's a wild card, as one constitutional lawyer told me, as far as if it would have any effect on abortion access and federally funded abortion.
I also want to point out quickly that several Black women stood up and said, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment, it's great for white women, but I don't think it's going to do anything for Black women. And some, Letitia Wallace, for example, representative who is leaving because she ran with Dan Biss in the primary for governor, she stood up and said, yes, I am going to vote for it. However, you know, you have to listen to Black women when they say they're afraid that this is not going to do anything. So, for example, Mary Flowers, a representative from Chicago, she stood up. She voted against it. She said, you know, this is nothing. I've spent my whole life being a Black woman, and I've had to fight for my rights every single day.
And I spoke to Carol Robles-Ramon. She's with a national group pushing for the ERA coalition. And I voiced those concerns to her. Mary Flowers had spoken at a previous hearing, you know, and she talks about there is a push when it comes to the feminist agenda, if you want to call it that, to be more intersectional, to have conversations that include women of color, women who are not heterosexual. And she argues that the Equal Rights Amendment will be an effective tool for women of color. And, you know, because, of course, they do face more violence and they do face more sexual harassment. That's what she told me anyway.
So I want to, we need to wrap this topic up because there's still a couple other important things to talk about this week. But Rachel, what are the chances that this actually becomes the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
Well, as Charlie Wheeler told me as I was going through the public affairs reporting program, never make a prediction. So I will not be doing that. However, if one more state were to ratify reaching that 38 number that was originally needed, what is clear is the battle will continue, probably in a legal sense as well. There's a proposal right now in Congress to lift that deadline, but some states had rescinded their vote. So there's the argument that, hey, if states are getting to vote on it later and ratify it, then those states that rescinded their vote should also be weighed in. So we'll see. The saga continues, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I'm sure this is not the last time we'll be talking about the Equal Rights Amendment. Daisy Contreras, I want to turn to you now. There was an unusual news conference in the Capitol this week. Can you tell us what was alleged?
Yeah, so while we're on the topic of ERA and Representative Liu Lang, an activist came out yesterday with allegations against Representative Lang over misconduct. And this is the lawmaker who championed the Equal Rights Amendment, the right, you know, for the past, I don't know how many decades. Marianne Longcar says she worked as an activist to help push to legalize medical marijuana, which Liu Lang was sponsoring. During the whole week, we kept hearing of an activist who would be coming forward to name a prominent lawmaker. And she said that Liu Lang made inappropriate advances, like allegedly touching her lower back and making suggestive comments. Then these comments became threatening over time. Longcar, it's interesting to note, also was joined by a one-time Republican House candidate, Denise Rothheimer, who previously accused another lawmaker of sexual harassment, if we recall. And Republican Representative Jeannie Ives was also in attendance in that press conference. Now, Liu Lang says that the allegations are not true, and he called for the Legislative Inspector General to investigate these allegations. And in doing so, he also decided to step down as House Deputy Majority Leader. He says that decision came about to make sure that there are no conflicts of interest, to make sure that there are no distractions from this investigation.
So, Hannah, this news conference went on for quite a while. There were a lot of questions, and it seemed like reporters were having a hard time sort of drawing out exactly, trying to understand. There was an allegation of a $170 million bribe, but that turned out to not really be what Ms. Longcar was suggesting it was, right?
Right. So what happened was we wanted to understand why Marianne Longcar felt like she was being retaliated against, and she said, well, I know some bad information about Liu Lang. And so we said, okay, when did you find out this information? What is the nature of this information? And eventually we drew out of her that she thought, or she alleged, that Lang and two other Democrats had been offered a $170 million bribe. And we said, that sounds like an awful lot for a bribe. Turns out it was an alleged offer of a state payment by a company named Medponics for all medical marijuana licenses during a stakeholder meeting. But also allegedly in this supposed meeting, that was shut down immediately. And so Longcar kept, you know, she insisted that it was some sort of bribe, and she insisted that that's the reason that Lang was retaliating against her, and also, you know, wouldn't let her work on bills, and said, you know, if you work on this bill, I'm going to kill this bill. It's just a lot there.
Yeah, and this is something that I think obviously, in 2018, we want to be careful to, you know, people deserve to have their stories heard.
Oh, absolutely.
And concerns like this. But there are a lot of questions here about, you know, there's the set of things where it's the inappropriate comments and the touching of the back. There's also this set of allegations about the way the legislative process plays out. And I think for those of us who are, you know, maybe more familiar here, there's a reason they call legislative, you know, sausage making, right? They say you don't want to see how sausage is made and you don't want to see how legislation is made. I saw your colleague, Rich Miller, had talked to somebody who was in the room when that offer was made and said that she had maybe been just sort of overwhelmed by everything that was happening. And he, as you said, he did not characterize it. This was something where apparently the company wanted to sort of come in and say, we're going to have all the licenses for these medical marijuana dispensaries, and was shouted down, including by Lang. Yeah. I think just to wrap this up, Lang requested a legislative inspector general investigation. That's happening. As Daisy said, he resigned from his leadership post, and I think we're just going to have to see how this process continues to play out. We've only got a few minutes left in the program. Want to make note, Charlie, President Trump, seemingly out of the blue, although I guess there's been a background late here, but President Trump says he might pardon former Governor Rod Blagojevich. This has been part of a long campaign. Patty, the former First Lady, has been going on Fox News, which we know the president watches pretty regularly. Blagojevich himself had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. Charlie, I wonder, do you think that Rod Blagojevich is going to be back in Illinois anytime soon?
If I were able to answer that question accurately, I'd have the ability to read President Trump's mind, and I don't think anybody can do that.
Fair enough.
No,
go ahead.
I was going to say, Blagojevich's corruption was beyond the pale, even for Illinois. He did the equivalent of going in and sticking up a bank. Most of the people who went to jail in Illinois have gone for the equivalent of rifling the candy machine at the front of the 7-Eleven.
And he had this thing that was bleeping golden, namely former President Barack Obama's Senate seat, and he was not giving it up for
The original indictment against Rod Blagojevich alleged that Blagojevich and several other people plotted, even before the election, for how they could enrich themselves with Rod in the governor's mansion.
Yeah. And, of course, I've long argued that it's actually not Blagojevich's, you know, federal corruption and the crimes, but his treatment of the state budget that actually did the more lasting damage. And we are still digging out from the decisions to not balance revenue and spending at that time. We are coming up on the end of the program, and time now for just real brief notes from the field. Hannah Meisel.
Well, on the heels of all of this sexual harassment allegations, the House and Senate briefly passed yesterday a package to change the process by which a legislative inspector general is chosen and the process by which sexual harassment allegations are treated within the LIG and Legislative Ethics Commission process.
Rachel Otwell.
The Voices Act, so-called Voices Act, passed both houses. Immigrants who are undocumented would be able to speak with law enforcement without their status having to be declared. Rauner last year signed the Trust Act, which limited state agencies' cooperation with federal officials. So we'll see if he signs this one.
And we're going to have to leave it there. So much more to talk about. 21 age for tobacco, still finding Legionella in the water at Quincy. Tune in next week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Daisy Contreras, Rachel Otwell, and Hannah Meisel. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.